Hello, welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we are going to be talking today about two movies that deal with childhood. The first being Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and the second being Frozen 2. So starting off with A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Mike, what did you think of the movie?
Well, first of all, by way of a bit of a background here, for whatever reason, culturally, and I love to speculate about this, there's this resurgence of interest in Fred Rogers. Last year, we had the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, which came out, and I really love that film. I saw it at a previous screening with a lot of people, and people were crying during it even. And I think the reason there fundamentally is, when you think of the fractious times we live in politically and generally, to have that kind of decency is so unusual. I mean, you know, he should be like, you know, made a saint or something, right? But that film really very deftly worked in the archival footage and so on. I remember, this is a very quick sideline, when that documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, came out last year, it actually was rated PG-13, and I thought, Did he use a naughty word or what? How did he get the 13? And in fact, the New York Times in its review, actually, where they usually explain the ratings, next to PG-13, they wrote, "What on earth is wrong with you people?" So that to the ratings board. Now, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is rated PG, so he's cleaned up his language here. And it's really, it's an enjoyable film, and I want to get your take on it first, and then I'll come in.
Well, I was not a fan of the show. I remember it being on. I don't remember ever watching it. He always seemed very, you know, square. And I think I was past the age, you know, where he was, you know, directing his efforts towards children. But having said that, I mean, every time it's come up, like with the documentary, I've never heard anybody say they disliked him or had any sort of bad thing to say about him. So I went thinking, well, I've seen the trailer, you know, the scene where the kids in the train are singing the theme song, you know, I can see, oh, that's probably going to make me cry. Bring a box of Kleenex. This movie just completely ran over me like a truck. I just found so many of those scenes snuck up on me. And it wasn't necessarily something you could identify as being overtly sentimental. It just reminds you so much of childhood. And so I tell people who say, well, you know, I wasn't really a fan of the show. You don't have to know anything about the show. You just have to remember what it was like to be a kid.
Now, a curious distinction here is that the documentary last year was very much about the show. And it was interesting to see the mechanics of it. Even though I didn't grow up watching it, I was certainly aware of it. And, you know, I've had that awareness since. But the fact that as you watch the documentary, you really got a sense of, well, how do they actually do it? You know, in terms of the other cast members and, you know, the behind the curtain kind of look, which
and
is interesting.
The educational parts they put in there, like, let's see how they make.
Yeah. All that's of interest. The feature film version we're talking about, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, is quite different in the sense that although you have a sense of the show, it's not really about the show. It's more about the relationship between Fred Rogers and a character. The character's name is Lloyd Vogel, very directly based, though, on the journalist Tom Juno, who actually had written a 1998 profile of Rogers for Esquire magazine, which I remember reading when it first came. I subscribed to Esquire at the time. I remember reading it. And essentially, the dynamics between those two, between the journalist and the television star, if you will, and, you know, the film we're talking about right now is very much about that back and forth between the two of them. And you see Rogers working his magic, not so much with the children on the show, because we really don't spend that much time on set, but really working his magic on the journalist who's come to interview him, because the journalist does have a bit of a troubled life himself. And so, in effect, trying to save his interviewer's life, if I can put it so dramatically or melodramatically. And so it's not a value judgment here as to whether one approach is better than the other, simply that you can easily watch these two films as companion pieces.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't feel that it was redundant, you know?
No, it really does give you a different kind of outlook. And of course, what this one has is Tom Hanks. Of course, the documentary obviously has the real person. And how can anything be better than that unless it's Tom Hanks, who they have determined is actually sixth cousins with Mr. Rogers?
Well, 6 degrees of separation. I think we're probably all related to him at this point.
Well, I think Tom Hanks does such an amazing job of embodying Fred Rogers. And when you think about it, he kind of has the same sort of persona. You know, in some ways, a lot of his movies could be considered, you know, family fare. Not all of them, of course. But he's just your basic nice guy.
Well, I'll agree and I'll disagree. I have to agree that he's a nice guy. That would be like saying Fred Rogers is not a nice guy. So I absolutely agree there. But in terms of embodying, I actually was prompted to look at some images and think it through here that Tom Hanks actually is a good deal chunkier than Fred Rogers. And I'm taking into account the cardigan sweaters, what those can do to you.
Yeah,
right?
Nobody looks really slender.
But the physicality of it, and it's not just a matter of making observation about, you know, whether he's heavier than the other, but there's more to it than that in the sense that there was an angularity to Fred Rogers and a kind of ardent quality he had. Bear in mind, he was a graduate of the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, so even though his preaching was low-key and geared to kids, it's there, right? There's an evangelical quality. And Hanks is able to convey that, but the physicality is different. In other words, with Rogers, I like to talk about the angularity of a performance. With Hanks, it's a more rumpled, more settled, filling out the sweater, if you will, you know, and there's a kind of chunkiness to it there, which doesn't invalidate him as a Mr. Rogers, but the physical resemblance is not actually as strong as it might be. Where it is strong is that because Hanks is a gifted actor, with the facial tics, with the voice, with so many ways in which he moves, he really does remind you of that. But push come to shove, I still felt like, even though on the face of it you might think it's ideal casting, they're actually very different in some ways, because Tom Hanks has always been a very extroverted actor and bringing that to a range of roles, but that extroverted quality, whereas Fred Rogers essentially was an introvert. A very nice guy, but kind of shy, kind of diffident. One reason why he wasn't pushy, wasn't overbearing, was the fact that he was so polite. He was so inward-looking in a lot of ways, as you would expect a theology student to be. But then he could stand and make the speech, sure, but in a very gentle, rolled-out, quiet kind of way. And again, Hanks is able to do that in the performance, but for my money, you know, a very measured, very studied performance. And so it technically very good, but I never quite entirely felt it. But since we're talking so much on our programs now about Academy Award nominations, I think it's a lock that he'll get one.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, how could they
if
not?
If only because the role is so likable. I mean, the audience responds so well to him. And I never even noticed the rumpled thing or that he was heavier. I just noticed the look in his eye was just really convincing. And Fred Rogers' widow, Joanne Rogers, has said that Tom Hanks is the perfect actor to play your late husband. Now, he has said this is the eighth time he's played somebody from real life. And he had said, he had told his agent, don't send me any more of those scripts. You know, I don't want to do any more real people. However, the director for this film, Marielle Heller, is friends with his son, Colin. And that's how she got to meet him at a party and gave him the script.
That's how people get roles. You got to go to parties.
Yes. We don't go to enough parties.
It's all about networking. Talent is good, but networking is great.
That is true of everything, though, when you think about it. I appreciate the effort that went into this to, you know, make it realistic. The puppets in the film are not the originals, but are meticulous recreations. Think of all the people who would know, you know, based on having seen the show. But they used the puppet makers for Sesame Street to recreate these and did a great job with that. Also, every location change in the movie was depicted with a scaled-down model of each piece, just like in the episode. So I thought it was kind of nice that, even though it is not about the show, they did incorporate aspects of it to tell the story, which I thought really worked.
Oh, they do. In fact, you know, I didn't want to overstate that. I mean, you do get some time on the set. You get a sense of the show itself. But in the documentary, you really feel like you're watching it being taped. You know, you're really there for all the construction and all the rehearsals and the whole process. Here, it's a bit more piecemeal. Let's put it that way. You have some time on the set, and you do get a sense of the show. But it's really more, as I say, the dynamics between the journalist and the television host.
They also swap in Tom Hanks in some archival footage on famous talk shows and stuff. This also occurred in Forrest Gump, so Tom Hanks is an old hand at that technique. One thing I'm glad that they did not go with accuracy is that apparently Mr. Rogers swam his laps in the nude.
I didn't know that. I wish I didn't know that.
Which, then you think, where did that come from, right? You
know, where did that come from?
Where did that come from? However, to keep the rating a PG, they showed him swimming in a bathing suit.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness. But, you know, just when you think you've heard everything there is to know about someone. So I want to ask you about the restaurant scene. They have included this in the trailer, so it's, you know, not a big reveal. But at one point, he is sitting in a restaurant with the journalist, and he says, you know, in his Tom Hanks, Fred Rogers kind of way, let's take a minute and think about all the people who care about us, basically all the people who loved us into being, something like that. And they shot it by having Tom Hanks do this extended look at the camera so that the viewers would understand that he's looking at them. And the way that worked in the movie when I was watching it, and it was a pretty full theater, of course, on screen, everybody in the restaurant goes quiet. But everyone in the theater went quiet. You could have heard a pin drop for that entire minute. He had everybody in thrall thinking about that very thing. We were part of the movie. And it was powerful. That's why bring a box of Kleenex, because these moments keep coming in the movie where you don't see it coming. And even when you see it coming, you don't think it's going to work. And then it really does.
Yeah, you know, on a film set, one of the cardinal rules for the actors typically, of course, is not to make eye contact with the camera eye. And you know, I've occasionally been on a set where an actor would inadvertently look to the eye, and man, it's like being slapped on the wrist. You're like, no, you can't look just off center. Don't, you know, unless it's something like Silence of the Lambs, where you know you're going to have Hannibal Lecter looking right into it and staring you down. You have to be careful when you do it and how often you do it. And so most films absolutely never have it. It's verboten. But there are places, and it's a good example you cite, where they flirt with that or beyond flirtation, actually make direct contact. But here it's certainly allowable and works quite well in that scene, because he would do things like that all the time on the show. I mean, I've seen, even though I didn't grow up watching the show, I've certainly seen excerpts of it. You know, he's telling a story, and at a certain point the camera goes in close, and it's almost like, well, how about you boys and girls at home kind of moment. And most children's television will have a moment like that. But even there, you don't want to be overbearing with it, because that's essentially, you'd be like waving your finger at the camera all the time, like, and now do this and eat your peas and carrots and all that, you know, so you don't want to do that too often. But that scene, I thought, worked really well. Now, in terms of the box of tissues, I might bring a few tissues, maybe not a full box. There are a few scenes where I thought was pushing a little too far. Like, I know you like the scene, I didn't care for it as much. The scene on the train in the mm-hmm. car there, where everyone knows the song and they all start singing and so on. To me, that gets a little smarmy at that point. And I think, oh, come on, give me a break.
You didn't even shed like one manly tear.
Not even an alligator tear. No, not even... Not even a single manly tear came. Even with glycerin in my eyes, it wasn't coming. I'm sorry. No, but that's just where I felt like a film that has honest and earned sentiment occasionally, I think, pushes a little too far with it. And that scene where, like, every passenger on this, was it a subway car? Mm-hmm. Like, every passenger on the subway car not only knows the song, but they all start singing. And it's, I don't know, it's just that kind of, like, smarmy, you know, it's a small world after all kind of moments where, you know, everyone's singing and happy. And I think these are human beings. They're not puppets.
But... I haven't seen the show, but I know all the words to the song. I think we all know all the words to the song.
Well, that happens. I mean, there's shows that I never watched, but the song was out in the culture, and it got into me as well. And, you know, you're driving down the highway for hours, and you can't get it out of your head. And I think that causes accidents more than anything else.
You could be right about that. Well, the film has three Oscar winners, Tom Hanks, Chris Cooper, and Christine Lottie.
Yeah, let's talk about some really good actors here. You know, the fact that you're spending all this quality time with the journalist Lloyd Vogel, the character name, Matthew Reese is the actor, incidentally, but that character's father, Jerry, is played by Chris Cooper. And Cooper is again, a good example of that kind of angry, middle-aged white male, if you will, who expresses anger well, oftentimes by being bottled up. And so when it comes out, it's like explosively out. So whenever you're in a room with him, thank God I'm not, but whenever you're in a room with him, you feel like at any moment this guy might either explode or implode. I'm going to find out which. But he brings that to bear here because the father is a piece of work, right?
Yeah, he is. He is definitely a piece of work. But I think that character, and it's overplayed because the author of the piece in Esquire said that in the movie, his name is Lloyd Vogel, and I get in a fist fight with his father. At my sister's wedding, he said, I did not get in a fist fight with my father at my sister's wedding. My sister didn't have a wedding.
I know. Well, you know, I mean, I've read the same quotes there, but you know what? I mean, this is a fictionalized treatment,
right? And it's supposed
right?
to be make him some sort of everyman. And I think most people have issues, and a lot of them have to do with
I mean, if his real
their,
life is so
parents.
Boring, I want to make it more interesting on screen, you know? Go ahead, fictionalize it. Give him a fist fight, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, that's a strong performance. Christine Lottie is not on screen for very long, but she's very effective too.
But you know what's nice about that? I mean, she's a really reliable actor and always a welcome presence. And I wanted more of her on screen. She plays the editor. She plays the journalist editor. I wanted more of her, but realistically, I thought, no, she really should just have one or two scenes. You know, she serves a function. She's the editor trying to guide this piece to publication. You know, you don't want to get bogged down in the mechanics of magazine journalism particularly, right? So if you had more scenes with her, it could go there. But she's so incisive an actor, she really makes an impression in what amounts to just a few minutes on screen.
Now, the people have been writing about Mr. Rogers since, you know, these two movies have been out. And I read something in the Post about a woman who thought, well, let me see what my kids, you know, kids today, how they'll react to Mr. Rogers. And she didn't think that it would go over well because, you know, it's sort of slow and kind of quiet and gentle. And the pacing is not like even Sesame Street is, you know, breakneck speed, changing between topics and things. She said, but they couldn't look away. And then later, when she asked them, you know, what is it about Mr. Rogers that you like? And they thought, duh, Mom, he likes kids. You can tell that he really likes children, like people, not like some people say that they like kids, but like he really sees them the way they are.
Well, it's an instance of where the plugged-in kids welcome the opportunity to unplug. That's a kind of almost counterintuitive now. We assume they always want everything to be fast and the furious paced, but sometimes to appreciate the slower virtues, which seem old-fashioned, the way Fred Rogers was. He wasn't exactly fashion-forward, right?
So. He was not. He worked those
cardigans.
Though. He really did. So I think Tom Hanks was terrific in this. I really cannot imagine anybody else doing it. But, you know, you said that physically he was wrong. Can you think of another actor that could have maybe pulled it off and looked more like Fred Rogers?
Christian Bale? You want him fat? He can be fat. You want him thin? He can be thin.
I don't know if I could see Christian Bale.
No, it's totally a joke. It's totally a joke. It's not.
He's a great actor, though.
I know he
I've
is.
Never
but
seen
I,
him in anything where he wasn't great.
I mentioned because he's so improbable.
Yeah, I can't see him doing something that is that sweet.
No, well, I know. That's why I said it.
Maybe Daniel Day-Lewis.
He's retired now, so.
All right, so we're not getting him. All right, any other things in this movie that you think would be nominated for? No, okay. So Tom Hanks is it, not even the screenplay.
That's actually, seriously, that would be a possibility, yeah.
Because I think without actually showing us, like you said, the redoing the documentary, it did show us the crux of the thing. I think it did that really well. Which brings us to Frozen 2. And, I mean, it has done great box office. And I know that you're not generally a huge fan of all things Disney and or animated. I'm going to give you a chance to...
I get to be the curmudgeon
on
staff.
You get to be the curmudgeon, and I've got a lot of great fun things to look for in the movie to follow.
Okay, so I've got to say, I was not a big fan. And speaking of songs that are like earworms from Frozen, I want to let it go already, you know. So you're right. I'm not the hugest fan. But, you know, joking aside on that, what I did like about the first one, and it gets followed through to some extent in the second one, is the fact that with Disney, we now have the new, we'll call it a positive stereotype of the power princess. Mm-hmm. Okay, long overdue, much needed, much appreciated. But now I think we're on the verge of having it being kind of formulaic, expected. Like, okay, well, what can you do with it? What I liked about Frozen and about the sequel as well is that even with most of those power princesses, at some point, well, you need a man, right? You know, where's the romance and so on? And even if she's leading the fight and he's a half step behind, still they're in the battle together, et cetera. Here, what was nice about the first one was the fact that you had that kind of a female self-reliance, if you will, and that you didn't have to automatically have, you know, somehow this, you know, romantic hookup and that you defer to the guy you're going to marry and so on. In effect, the women could work together is what I'm saying. And of course, in the films, both of them, of course, you have Elsa and Anna. So you have that kind of 1-2 combination there. And that carries over from film to film. It's one reason why, even though the first film came out in 2013, ordinarily you would say 6 years is a long time to go between an original and a sequel. Audiences lose interest, they move on. I think not here. There's such an audience for Frozen, and anyone with young kids knows that, and such a huge following that I wasn't surprised that the sequel opened with a really big box office. I mean, worldwide, it's going to be one of the biggest box office films of the year. And so the feminist dynamics, if you will, for the preteen set are all still there. It all gets locked in. It works just the same. But I'm not the only person to point this out is that it's still Disney in some ways. It's still, like, for instance, it doesn't hurt to have a wasp waist and blonde hair and blue eyes. You know, it can get you places in this world. Let me pick up your feelings on that, because sometimes the films almost seem to be at odds with themselves. They're being more affirmative, whether it's, you know, in terms of, you know, women in the workplace, the royal palace workplace, whatever. And yet, you know, it's being affirmative, and yet by the same token, in some ways, it still seems kind of tethered to older expectations. What do you think of that?
Well, I have to say that I find the two female leads the least interesting part of both movies. The star for me, and I think, you know, one of the reasons I think people go back is for Olaf.
Oh, okay.
And Olaf has all the best animation because he comes apart And there's even some funny things that he does. There's a point where they're, I think they're playing charades, yeah, and he acts out a mouse, and he uses the coals, and you know, on his head to be Mickey Mouse. They also reference the whole Mickey Mouse thing. There's a point where Elsa is singing Into the Unknown, and she spins around and creates a circle of ice on the ground, and for a split second, they add two circles at the top to make it look like Mickey Mouse. So they sneak it in twice.
That's a great observation, but do you think as audiences turn out, I mean, I enjoyed Olaf a whole lot too, but do you think that's really the big selling point? In other words, when people go to see it, it's not being sold based on him. I mean, he's I think, one of the most amusing things in the film, I agree with you. But in terms of the overall sales pitch, if you will, it's still the Power Princess kind of sales pitch, isn't it?
Well, all the little girls going to the movie want to either be Elsa or Anna.
Who wants to be Olaf?
But when you buy the stuffed animal, it's Olaf.
Aha. See, it's all about marketing. And, you know, it's no accident that this comes out just before Christmas. And I've been in a few stores, and I've been subjected to all that, too. And believe me, you know, you're going to make, like, you know, as we speak, the film's made already more than $700 million. It's going to be, by the time people are listening to us, it'll be over $1 billion. And you know what? Probably as much in the marketplace for toys. Walking down the aisles, I was afraid they were going to topple on top of me. I wouldn't want to be killed by Olaf.
Olaf would never...
He would come to pieces, would I? You know?
Yeah, I think part of the whole appeal of the second movie is to revisit those characters. So, you know, for kids who really liked the girl power, or, you know, finally a Disney princess that I feel like, you know, I can still have agency. It also has other fun characters, like Olaf, if you like that. They also, they give you a couple of other reminders of other movies that you like. There's a Baymax figure in one scene, and then another one where you see Totoro from My Neighbor Totoro. So you get to see things that are like, oh yeah, those people, we just got to see them again, which I think is part of the fun. And then they do fun things with Olaf, like he does a motion with his hands like Marilyn Monroe with her dress blowing up from the 7-year itch. And, you know, that's for the adults.
Yeah, you know what? That's a really good point to make, or points to make, because increasingly, and by increasingly, I mean like the last 20-some years, these animated features, which once were always called family movies, i.e. geared for the kids, they've become for everybody. And oftentimes, you know, it's adults going on a date. It's the older people going to see the film as well. And a lot of those inside jokes, those references, would just sail beyond a kid. But so what? Because if there's a little reference like the Marilyn Monroe one you mentioned, you know, it goes by in a second or two. An older viewer might get it and laugh at that. If it flies by a 5-year-old, so what? These are busy films, right? It goes on to something else immediately.
It's also showing him doing something cool.
It's cool on its own. It's like an added bonus to get the reference there. And films like this tend to be self-referential. They play off of the history of the genre. They play off of the first film. And in terms of repeated elements, the dynamics of the sisters and so on, you know, I've got some younger relatives, and I know from painful experience that you could be sitting in the living room and it'd be one of those Disney animated films which they've seen dozens of times. And you watch it again and again. It's ritualistic that way. And the fact that it's familiar actually is a virtue. It's a selling point. It reinforces things. So the fact that the sequel plays out so many of the same elements, that's not at all a negative thing here. It actually is, you're happy to see those people again, for one thing, Olaf and the others. I'll now refer to all the other characters as just the others, just Olaf and the other guys. But also, like, the story elements are still locked in place in a way that, you know, people want that. They want something reassuring. They want something they're familiar with. And, you know, more power to them for that. I mean, it's an enjoyable film.
Well, also for mom and dad coming, who are bringing the kids to the movie, during Kristoff's Lost in the Woods number, there's a moment where he's singing and three reindeer are behind him in a triangular arrangement, resembling the music video for Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm sure you noticed that. The other one that I noticed was the Lost in the Woods is done in a kind of a 1980s power ballad, and recreate scenes from well-known videos, including those from Whitesnake and Queen.
Okay, so those are additional reasons to watch, right?
Well, no, they're like little inside jokes.
No, I know. They're what I refer to as incidental pleasures.
Yes.
That you're enjoying the film on its own, but it's always nice. And any kind of film geek or film teacher loves things like that. And we're always encouraging our students to, you know, watch for little things like that. And I love the inside references that way. And animated films, you know, think about that genre. It really lends itself to that kind of thing. There's so much you can do, you know, visually and orally to evoke, you know, some earlier film or something familiar that way, for sure.
Now, they reveal in this movie some of the details of the parents of Elsa and Anna's how they, why they are no longer with us. But a longstanding fan theory, which the film directors kind of went along with, was that Anna and Elsa's parents didn't drown, but actually washed up on the shores of Africa, where they had a son who went on to become Tarzan. So they dispelled that in this movie, but wouldn't that have been an interesting...
It might yet be. Sequelitis. Frozen in Africa? Maybe on top of Mount Kilimanjaro.
On the top of the map, the sisters find when they're searching the remains of the parent ship is the text MDCCCXL, which is Roman numerals for 1940, which is around the time the Snow Queen came out, the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale that is the basis of the movie.
Yeah.
And there's another reference in a flashback where Prince Agnar says he's reading a book by some new Danish author. Which is probably another allusion.
I like
to
that one. I laughed
Christian
at that
Anderson.
One. But I was the only one in the theater who laughed at that line.
Oh, I laughed in a different theater when I saw it. So we both laughed.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a good line. So I did think the movie was absolutely beautiful to look at, really nicely done. By the way, here's another fun fact to know and tell. Since Elsa was never barefoot in the original movie, the animators didn't bother giving her toes. So they had to remodel her feet with toes for the sequel. So Frozen 2, toe version. This, by the way, was John Lasseter's final involvement with Walt Disney Animation Studios.
Yeah, and we'll see about that. I mean, he's had some personal circumstances.
He might
come back. We'll see.
We'll see. So besides the fact that it was good to look at and did make good money, I don't know that this will be nominated for Best Animated Feature.
Oh, it'll definitely be nominated for Best Animated Feature. You can't deny that kind of box office. You can't deny the lineage going back to Frozen. It won't necessarily win, let's put it that way, but it's definitely going to be nominated.
So, any movies coming up at the end of this year or any movie from this year that is your current favorite, the one to beat?
Well, there are a few recent films I'd highly recommend. I've seen The Irishman. I actually saw it in a theater. And I strongly recommend that you spend those 3.5 hours. To the extent that a film like that can flow, it really does flow. And it's just a great experience to have Martin Scorsese working again with Robert De Niro and until recently retired Joe Pesci and so on, and working for the first time with Al Pacino. It really follows through on so much of the gangster material they've dealt with over the decades. But kudos also here to the technical team. That editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, who's been with Scorsese for decades, she really keeps it a tight 3.5 hours, if I can put it that way. And I just thought it was a really, really strong film, certainly one of the best of the year. The very recent release that's also in somewhat limited release, but I strongly recommend, is Marriage Story, by Noah Baumbach. He's going to get nominations as writer and director of the film, I think, and for sure 2 Oscar nominations in the lead categories for Adam Driver as the husband and Scarlett Johansson as the wife, who are in the process of getting divorced. Now, the film runs a little long. I know I say that a lot. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. There were a lot of places where I would want to trim it and hold it back, and it does get excessive. But couples who are divorcing have been known to have long-winded arguments, right? And where would you cut some of those? But it's brilliantly acted. In fact, it's some of the best acting I've seen all year. In supporting actor categories, the actors include Laura Dern, Alan Alda, Julie Haggerty, and Ray Liotta, and they're all terrific. So I'm thinking at least a few of them will get Academy Award nominations.
How can you go wrong with an ensemble like that? Unless, you want to compare that with Knives Out real quickly.
Oh, Knives Out is really enjoyable. And speaking of spoiler alerts, got to be really careful with that one. But it actually opened a relatively strong second to Frozen 2. It's a true example of word of mouth. And the people who saw it, they were really pulled into it. And I heard people talking about it on the way out. They weren't just talking about where we parked the car and where we're having dinner and all. They were talking about Knives Out in terms of what happens in the story. It's an Agatha Christie-style story. It has no direct connection to her, but it's that kind of style. Like all of these eccentric and dangerous characters in the same house. And the mysteries that will be unveiled there, right? And it really plays out in the kind of enjoyable way you want. And it does get pretty ridiculous at times, but that's what you want. You want really extreme behavior, right? You want things to be acted out.
Well, based on the trailer, I was surprised it was Ryan, the director. I didn't know it was him. I thought surely it was Guy Ritchie.
Oh.
It has that kind of madcap feel to it.
Yeah, it does. It does, actually. It's that kind of madcap story there where, it gets, violent but in a silly way, and there's all the intrigue, and you just really enjoy watching it. It's okay to enjoy a movie, and I think this movie's really enjoyable. How's that for a plug?
That's a good plug. That's a great plug. I think we're coming to the end of our segment, so we will have to see you at the movies over the Christmas break because we will be back next year. But you can find us online and see some of our past shows at www.dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. So we will see you at the movies.
Talk to you next year.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.